Sometimes the fun begins when the paved road ends. Chevy Silverado 2500 HD is made to work hard and play hard on the road or off. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for details and experience life in HD.
Yeah, so I was saying earlier, I am a big World War II history buff, which I think a lot of us are here at WGN. I often wonder if the newer generation, the next generation, Gen Zers, I'm sure they are, or Gen Alphas even, feel that connection to World War II like a lot of us do. My grandparents both were in combat. I'm sure many of your fathers and uncles and grandparents were as well, depending on your age. And I just find the D-Day landing, you know, made so infamous by Saving Private Ryan and all the films and other things that have been done about it, I find the whole lead up to it just incredibly fascinating. As we approach the 80th anniversary, I've been seeing so many stories about President Biden's going to be going to Normandy. A lot of World War II vets I've read are going. Some, I believe they had a, I don't know where I heard this, a 102-year-old boarded a plane to go to Normandy to land there and be there for the honoring of the D-Days. I don't know if celebration is the right word, but of course it was the momentum changer in the war in Europe. But I find the lead-up days so interesting too, because of all the things that could have gone wrong and the things that were going wrong. And I thought maybe I'd share a couple of the lead-up day stories to it here. I'll go back a couple days because I decided to do this today. I wasn't on the air for a couple days. But as early as May 31st, the first troops were started to be loaded onto the ships and the landing craft that would take them to Normandy. It took 5 days. The whole process of just getting soldiers onto ships took 5 whole days. So they started it on the 31st of May. On June the 1st, so that would be 80 years ago past Saturday, the first part of the decoding messages were sent to the French Resistance. It was June the 1st, 1944, and in the evening, they used part of a poem by Paul Verlaine. I don't know if I'm saying that name correctly. It was broadcast by the BBC, and it had the phrase, "The heavy sobs of autumn's violins." Then the French Resistance had their code breakers. They'd go in and figure out what that meant, and it was a coded warning directly to the French Resistance, relating plans to carry out railway sabotage, that they would ruin some of the railways on their way into Normandy. And the Germans got that message. They knew it was significant. They didn't quite know what it meant, but they knew that an invasion was likely soon. If I was going to say President Eisenhower, but of course General Eisenhower, at his point, he had moved his advance command post to the woods in southern England, a base for him to work in that area. On the 2nd of June, there was a security scare. Listen to this. For the fifth time in a month, one of the D-Day code names had appeared as a crossword clue in the Daily Telegraph in the UK. There was huge concern that there had been a leak and that the Daily Telegraph perhaps had a spy inside of it that knew what was happening with the movements of the Allies and was trying to relate something to the French. In this case, it was the code name Neptune, which was the code for the naval assault crossing. It turned out that it was a crazy coincidence. A school headmaster had actually compiled all those crosswords months ago, and 5 of them just happened to contain code words for the incoming invasion. Also on June the 2nd, so yesterday, 80 years ago yesterday, the first part of the invasion fleet set off for Normandy. 2 Royal Navy X-craft, which were basically mini submarines, they arrive off the Normandy coast on the next day, June the 3rd, 80 years ago today, and they will stay submerged there till D-Day, when they will surface to glide in the first Allied craft at the 2 beaches, Juno and Sword. Can you imagine you're in these submarines going across the channel, and you just submerge just off the coast of Normandy, and you have to wait there, silent, for days? No doubt the German Navy will be listening for any pings in the water, and they had to sit there. The invasion was supposed to be June the 5th still at this time, 80 years ago. They thought it'd be a day earlier. But on June the 2nd, they sailed and sat there for 4 days waiting in silence. We move to 80 years ago today. Early in the morning, the chief Allied weather forecaster, Group Captain James Stagg, predicted bad weather for D-Day. At this point, they still thought it would be June the 5th. The forecast is not improved by the evening. There's going to be low clouds, strong winds, rough seas. Winston Churchill visit Portsmouth. U.S. airborne troops were briefed about D-Day. They told they are going to Normandy on the 5th. But still, as of this moment, 99% of the troops who will take off in 3 days and land on the beaches of Normandy had no idea where they were going or that they were going yet. They think they're going in 2 days and no one has been briefed yet on what's happening. Anyways, I found that interesting. Tomorrow we'll do June the 4th, obviously, all leading up to D-Day. Bob Kessler, I don't know, did you know anyone, any of your parents, grandparents, uncles, aunts serve that were part of D-Day that you know of or no?
Anyone in my family? Yeah, I don't think, let's see, my great uncle, Sam Kessler, Indiana hog farmer, was in the Big Red One, the 1st Infantry. I think he was in North Africa, though.
Oh, wow. Still. Yeah, that was where the war was fought first. Just some really interesting texts coming in. One person wanted to know, as I was talking about the lead up to D-Day, 262, what does the D stand for in D-Day? And that is an answer I had no idea what the answer was. I Googled it, and the best answer I can see, take that for what it's worth, seems to be that it doesn't stand for anything. It was a coded designation used by the military to indicate the start date of a major operation or invasion. So just a military term. The days before and after D-Day are referred to as D-minus or D-plus, followed by a number. Which leads me to a text that I got about someone from the 630. They said that my father-in-law was D-Day plus 4, so that would be June the 10th. He was 19 years old. The things he saw and was a part of were unthinkable. So important to keep their stories alive and share with our younger generations. Yeah, I agree completely. I've always been interested in it, and I don't know if it's just because maybe that we're all interested in it because either our fathers, uncles, maybe you yourself, your grandparents served in the wars. And as the generations go on, I don't know if there's that connection. Certainly, I'm sure it's taught in schools, obviously, what happened. But without that knowing someone that served or had met someone, maybe it's harder to make those connections for newer generations. The 630, my husband's great uncle, died on the beach. The 224 says, thanks so much for sharing the information about D-Day. I've been to Normandy. I can't begin to fathom the bravery of those troops. Boy, ain't that the truth. And the best you can get a sense of it, if you don't see the real videos, or Saving Private Ryan, and just seeing that, I think, awoke a lot of people to what that must have been like. My grandfather, on my dad's side, saw combat in the Pacific as a paratrooper who would sneak behind enemy lines without a gun and have to free camps of prison camps. He didn't like to talk about it. I don't blame him. We didn't talk much about it. I wish he, for my own sake, selfishly wish he had opened up about it, but he didn't want to, and that's okay. He passed a couple years ago. But to just think about that, in the middle of the night, he would jump out of a plane, land somewhere with no firearm, or at least one that they weren't supposed to use, and have to free a camp of prisoners is just mind-boggling to think of 19 or 20 years old. I've heard often that the only way we could have won that war was with a bunch of 18, 19, or 20-year-olds, because once you get to 25, 26, 27, you probably don't want to do that. You know better. You know, you'd think you send a bunch of 18-year-olds or even younger, that maybe that's the best way to have done that. I don't know. 312-981-7200. Any thoughts about that? Pete, should I go to line one there? Let's get Claire on the line here. Claire, you're on WGN. Hi, Claire.
Hi. Oh, good morning to you. And I'm so grateful that you're even talking about it, but it was hard for the people in there. My dad was on the first troop transfer ship, the Navy taking the kids, as he said, out there. My dad, of course, survived, and otherwise I wouldn't have been here, right, and all my grandkids, but praise the Lord, he made it home alive, but his ship was, of course, blown up. All of them were destroyed. Even the mascot, the dog, everything was destroyed. And it was so sad because he went out that morning, said, goodbye, sweetheart. He said he knew he'd be rejected because he was old and he had flat feet. And he said, I'll see you later. He says, oh, honey, don't worry. I'll be home for probably for lunch even later. And he went in and he called her up later and says, I'm going. He got picked.
Wow.
And he was like an old guy. He was 30. You know, he felt like the old guy. And he was put on the first ship that was transporting the kids. He said, how pathetic. It was just kids running to the beach.
Insane.
But praise the Lord, he's home. God is good.
God is good. Claire, thanks for sharing that story. We appreciate it.
And he shared with us. He loves his country. He loved his country to the end. God bless you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Claire. 847, my father was in the third wave on D-Day. After seeing Private Ryan, Saving Private Ryan, as he was a very old man, he was asked how realistic it was. With tears in his eye, he said they didn't show enough of the dead bodies on the beach. Yeah, boy, to actually have been there and then to see the movie years later to try and make any sort of comparison, I don't know. D-Day anniversaries, World War II thoughts in general. I wanted to get Grace on the line here. Hey, Grace, how are you today?
Just fine, thank you, John.
What are you thinking? What do you got for me?
Well, I was 6 years old when my dad was drafted in World War II, and I'm 85 years old now, and I still will never forget it. It was very traumatic for me, and the first Christmas without my dad, all I did was cry. It was horrible. And then one day during the summer, I was outside with my brother, who at the time was 2, and I looked down the street and I thought I saw somebody carrying something over his shoulder. And he came from the streetcar line, and we were one block in from it, and all of a sudden I saw it and I knew it was him. It still brings tears to my eyes because I was very close to my dad, and it was him. I remember just jumping on him, and it was just wonderful to have him home, and we were very close, and unfortunately, he died at 72, but he's always in my heart.
Grace, you're going to get me to cry on the radio. First of all, to be able to chat with someone who was at an age as a kid where you're young, but you know what was happening and knew what was happening when he was shipped off, and to hear that there was was he just on leave when you saw him, or was that when he came home for the final time?
No, he came home for good.
Oh, my goodness. Was he in the Pacific or the European theater?
He was in China. My brothers could probably tell you the name of the ship, but I can't. But I have a lot of memorabilia because he sent me postcards and letters addressed to me, and I have wonderful, beautiful artifacts from China.
Wow.
That I treasure.
Ugh. Well, I'm sorry your dad is passed, obviously, although... 72.
Well, I'm 85, so, you know, he would have been gone by now.
Yeah.
He'd be over 100.
Yeah, but, well, we still thank him and all the other men and women, too, and kids who had to endure a lot, kids overseas and kids like you, the war at home, too. Grace, that was a wonderful call. Thanks for sharing that with us, okay?
Thank you.
Have a good rest of your day, all right. Oh, that was sweet. I can't imagine. See your dad coming home. She said she was 6 when he shipped off. I don't know if she was 7, 8, 9 when he came back, but boy, that's a core memory that sticks with you. When I picture June 6th, obviously we're all going to be talking about D-Day on that day, but I like to kind of rewind back through time to kind of talk about the lead up through big events, and D-Day certainly fits the bill on what was happening for this massive military operation in the days leading into D-Day. And we did it yesterday. We recapped the previous couple days on June the 3rd. And where we left off on June the 3rd, 1944, excuse me, and the last report we had was we didn't know what the weather would be like. On June the 4th, 1944, 80 years ago today, at 4:15 in the morning, all the Allied commanders, they gathered together to talk about the weather forecast once again with Group Captain James Stagg. And it's at that point, less than 24 hours before the invasion was set to begin, they decide to postpone the invasion, which would otherwise instead take place on June the 6th. The ships had already started going and had to be recalled back to shore. The ships that were getting ready and had already left had to come back. And you might wonder, well, what's the big deal about delaying a day? Some of you probably know this, but if they couldn't have done it June the 6th, they may have been able to do it June the 7th. But if they went any further, they would have had to wait until July. The entire operation hinged on the tides and the placement of the moon to be able to safely ferry all those people across the channel with the right illumination or lack thereof in the sky, and for the tide to be timed appropriately where it was I believe I'll have to double check this, but I think they wanted high tide in the morning of the invasion. So when you start calculating all those things through, there's just not that many days where that all lines up. If the weather had been bad enough on June the 6th, that would have led to a big issue. Okay, so 4:15 in the morning, 80 years ago today, they decide we're not going to do this on the 5th. We're going to try on the 6th. Simultaneously, a twist of fate happens on the German side. The German commander in Normandy at 6 in the morning on June the 4th, 1944, Erwin Rommel, he was commanding in Normandy. He decides to go to Germany for his wife's birthday, which is on June the 6th. He plans to return to France a couple days later. He believes that the weather is too bad for the Allies to land at any time when he goes away for a long 4 days to see his wife's birthday. And that, of course, would play fate as well. And the invasion, of course, happens. At 1 o'clock in the afternoon on June the 4th, 1944, the AP mistakenly reports that the invasion has begun. A teletype operator is practicing and doesn't realize that the machine is connected to the entire network of AP reporters. The news is broadcast around the world. It goes out on radio that the invasion has begun. Quickly, 5 minutes later, the AP issues a correction. Ooh, you wonder if the wrong flag goes up the wrong pole, what happens next? That's on June the 4th. Later on that evening, Allied forecasters, they all gather together at 9 at night on the evening of June the 4th, and they predict a 36-hour slight improvement in the weather. They say it's not going to be perfect, but it should be good enough to allow airborne naval operations all to take place. It does seem possible, as the Allied commanders go to bed on this day 80 years ago, that it looks like D-Day will be indeed on June the 6th. So they wake up in the morning, think it's going to be the next day. They change course, reverse it, bring the ships back, and then they gather at night and say, okay, I think we're able to do this. It's a busy day in the world on June the 4th, 1944. It was a Sunday. On that day, 2 days before D-Day, Rome fell to the Allies as they marched up the peninsula. Very little fighting in the city itself. The American tanks rolled on the Appian Way as they liberated Rome. And in an interesting twist of fate, the Germans ignored Hitler's order to blow up all the bridges. And they retreated, and the city's historic sites were left intact. And off the coast of Africa, a really interesting story that connects to Chicago is happening on this day on June the 4th as well. The Allies had learned from decrypted German messages that U-boats were operating near Cape Verde, but their exact locations were not known. So they sent out aircraft carrier. They also sent out some smaller boats, ships, destroyer escorts. I don't know the whole history. And on June the 4th, one of the ships made contact with what they believed was one of the German U-boats. It was called the Chatelaine. That was the name of the destroyer. It was so close to the submarine that the depth charges, those things they would drop in the water and that would explode, they wouldn't sink fast enough to intercept the boat. They were right on top of it. So they actually fired what they called hedgehog anti-submarine mortars into the sea, and that was able to I obviously don't know the military way of doing this, but they were able to eventually hit the U-boat. They saw an oil slick. It came up to the surface. Now, the Germans did, to scuttle the boat. They opened the valves to try and sink it. They left the engines running. The rudder had been damaged, and the submarine came up to above the sea, and he ordered a single torpedo, the Americans did, to destroy the German submarine, and it missed. And because that missile missed, that submarine eventually would make its way to 5700 South DuSable Lakeshore Drive in Chicago, Illinois. That is the U-505 submarine at the Museum of Science and Industry. That's there today, all because they missed on a missile to try and sink it. All of that happening in World War II on June the 4th, 1944. A busy day at that, and D-Day minus two. John Hanson in for John Williams. I have awoken the history nerds amongst our listeners, including myself, as we go up to D-Day. A lot of people chiming in with their own little nuggets they've learned or remember about the D-Day invasion. 847, I think they texted yesterday, too, about the account of the D-Day invasion. I was talking about how The German commander went to go home for for his wife's birthday, thinking that the Allied invasion couldn't happen on June the 6th. 847 reminds me that Hitler was not to be awoken that day. Those were the orders on June the 6th in the morning. And he was the only one capable of releasing what's called the reserve panzer units, the tanks that could go and try and intercept the troops that were landing in Normandy. Yeah, there's like a billion documentaries about D-Day and about mistakes made by both sides, but especially the Germans. And I have watched them all, I assure you. Any new one that comes on Netflix, boy, or any of them, I will watch it. I will sit there, Pete, with no sound and watch World War II in color. When they colorized the film, I think my grandfather had those tapes in the 70s, and I'll sit there in silence. Or they'll play like orchestral music behind everything that's happening. I can't get enough of it. I'm fascinated by it, probably because, as I mentioned yesterday, you know, most of us have a personal connection to someone that we knew that was there, that was serving in one way or the other. I did not know until I looked it up this morning the story of the U-505 and its capture that eventually led to the submarine at the Museum of Science and Industry, which they brought in. They had to hide from the Germans that we had it. They didn't want to let them know that we had it. We looked through the technology. We learned a lot from the boat. Those prisoners were at POW camps here in the United States, which is, again, another fact of the war I think gets lost to people, that there were POW camps around our area where German prisoners were. The war seems so far away, but in many ways it was so close. Not to mention U-boats were spotted off the coast of New York, the coast of Washington, D.C., all throughout the war. I mean, they were close. But they brought that U-505 through the St. Lawrence Channel, brought it all the way down to Lake Michigan, eventually loading it off on the beach, I believe. I'll have to remember all those details. Bob, I don't know if you've been to the U-505 exhibit at the Museum of Science and Industry.
I have. It's been quite a while, though.
It's so interesting. When I was a kid, it was outside. They originally had the submarines.
I remember that, yes.
Sitting outside, they had like a little tunnel that you'd go in to get it. Now if you haven't seen it since they've brought it inside, although it's probably been 20 years, they have built an incredible exhibit at the MSI, or the Griff, as we'll call it in future years. But a lot of interesting texts coming in about some of the history that happens. The 847, I mentioned that the AP accidentally reported that the invasion had begun. 847 says, about the account of the D-Day invasion, I could see myself being that teletype operator screwing up the message, almost causing a catastrophe. Yeah, I'm kind of that way too. I could see myself hitting the wrong button and sending an alert that almost messed up the whole thing out to the world. 312-981-7200. So you got a lot of options. You can text about that. Some people texting about, surprisingly, I'm shocked, most people seem, at least on the text line, to be just fine with taxing DraftKings and FanDuel 40%, and says they'll be fine. They'll make their money. No big deal. That's what a lot of people say. 847 says, yeah, Rome was liberated a day or two before D-Day. It was 2 days. That's what I got to read. We also have some, we just lost Dave. I was going to bring him up about a word that he says he couldn't say. You can call back, Dave, if you've got it. 630, if John was my teacher when I was in school, I would have enjoyed history class a lot more. Thank you, Joyce. Yeah, history was the one subject that I was in for. I was the social studies student of the year, Bob Kessler, at Downers Grove South High School, class of 2002.
You do have a gift for, what is it, depicting history.
Oh, thank you.
You really do.
That's kind. I just love it so much. I think you got to appreciate it in your own way, and that's how I do it. Let's go to Larry. Larry's on WGN. Hey, Larry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was in the Navy stationed out in the Tacoma, Seattle area, and it's quite well known out there. There were some Japanese mini subs in Puget Sound right off Seattle.
Whoa.
So that was always interesting. And I thought I saw something on a History Channel that there were even some mini subs in Lake Michigan. I don't remember that for sure, but I know the Puget Sound thing. They were right there.
I'll have to look that up about the mini subs. I'd be surprised if they got through the St. Lawrence Channel all the way through, but I don't know. I'll have to look that up, Larry. Thanks for the call. All the way in Puget Sound. That's crazy. Okay. Larry agrees. He's speechless. The 815 says the airborne Rangers led the way. They were dropped in behind enemy lines the night before June the 6th. Okay, I'm going to cover that tomorrow, everybody. That's June the 5th. I'm trying to walk into this, everybody. I'm trying to walk us through the week of what it was like. You know, then we talk about D-Day and the surprise that it was or wasn't. I mean, everyone knew it was going to happen at some point. They didn't quite know where. Just think of the wives and the kids back at home just waiting to hear what would happen. Oh, yeah. Can't even imagine it. Okay, all week long, I've been kind of giving you the step-by-step, the day-by-day on where we were on this day 80 years ago, as, of course, we get closer to tomorrow and the 80th anniversary of D-Day on Normandy. Before I get to D-Day, I just find it so fascinating how many other things were happening in military operations on this day, June the 5th, 1944. First and foremost, Operation Forager began, which was a campaign in Japan on the Mariana Islands. The campaign began on this day as a major fleet left Pearl Harbor sailing for those islands. Operation Matterhorn began on this day with B-29 Super Fortress combat missions bombing Bangkok and airfields in India. It just gives you the scope of how massive this war operation effort is that there are major battles and preparations happening in the Pacific. At the same time, the Allies are getting ready to have an armada cross the English Channel and liberate Europe. All happening at the same time, all managed by one president and allies from the countries. It's just incredible. Meanwhile, Rome, as we mentioned yesterday, Rome was liberated 80 years ago yesterday. Today, the anniversary of the Battle of Anzio, which is a city nearby, ended after 136 days the Allies won. Rome was declared an open city occupied by the U.S. Army on this day 80 years ago. The King of Italy transferred most of his remaining constitutional powers to his son, the Pope, on this day 80 years ago. Pope Pius VII spoke to crowds at St. Peter's Basilica, giving thanks to God and all the belligerents, the army combatants, for largely sparing Rome from destruction. We mentioned that yesterday. U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt, the night before D-Day, gave a fireside chat on the fall of Rome. The first of the Axis capitals is now in our hands, Roosevelt says. One up and two to go. Referring obviously to Germany and Japan. Now to D-Day. What's happening in England as they get ready? Early morning hours, 4:15 in the morning on June the 5th, 1944, the Allied commanders meet one final time to discuss something they've been discussing all week, the weather. The last weather forecast comes in. The forecast, better than they thought. The day before, they thought, well, we'll go. It may not be perfect. It wasn't perfect, but it was good. And they decide at that moment that D-Day will definitely take place 24 hours from then, June the 6th. A few hours later, some of the junior officers, they had been given their sealed orders not to be open until told to do so. They open them up and they find out the location of the landings. Up until this point, very few people knew where the armada was going to land and how they were going to do it. The orders had been drawn up. They had been sent. They had been sealed. And when they were open, that's when people learn what is their fate to be, where they're going. 6 in the morning, just a couple hours later, the first Allied troop convoys begin to leave England's south coast ports. 24 hours before they land, the first troops start going into the sea. Some ships need to set off early due to their slow speed and the distance they are traveling. Think about that. You're sending an armada across the channel. First of all, you're hoping not to be caught and to ping the Germans on exactly what is happening. Second of all, big boats go slower than small boats, I've learned, so they have to time out exactly how that works. And just the logistics of fueling up these ships, loading these ships for days, sending them off perfectly timed so that as morning breaks, the right ships arrive at the right order. And by the way, there's mines throughout the channel, so minesweepers are going through clearing this whole way, hoping none of them go boom, not only to not save lives, but not to rouse any suspicion. We fast forward to the evening of June the 5th, 1944. General Eisenhower visits the U.S. 101st Airborne Division near Newbury, England, only hours before they're set to leave France. There's a great picture of him visiting the troops. And at about 11 at night, around this time, the British and American airborne troops begin taking off from bases in England. They will be the first Allied soldiers to land in Normandy by glider, by parachute, in the early hours the following morning. Yeah, in many ways, D-Day began the day before, not only with Operation Tonga. That was the name of the operation there, the code name given to the airborne operation by the British 6th Airborne Division. the paratroopers and the gliders. That was the night before. Many of them blown way off their course, landing miles from where they were supposed to, in the hedgerows of France, not having any idea where they were supposed to be. Those that survived having to regroup and fight behind enemy lines to start to try and deplete the German resources behind the beaches. But also, the day before, on June the 5th, D-Day naval deceptions began. There were Operations Taxable, Glimmer, and Big Drum, tactical military deceptions conducted to support the landings. Basically, small boats simulated invasion fleets approaching different coasts, different places. The Germans knew an invasion was coming. They didn't know when, they didn't know where, and we were trying to confuse them the entire way. So those operations went off to many different bases to try and show that here it comes, and nope, not over here. Don't look over here. Here it is. It's incredible the amount that went into it. And then we get to midnight June the 6th, and we get to that tomorrow on the actual landings on the beaches. I can't imagine being an officer opening up. I mean, just think of the anticipation. I mean, the day off, scary enough as can be, but you're 18 years old. You're told tomorrow is the day. You look left, you look right, you know some of your friends, some of your brothers in arms. They are not going to make it through the liberation of Western Europe. And you just have to sit there and wait. Do you get sleep? I mean, do you sleep that night? I know it's important for operations to do that, to have a good night of rest, but especially the Navy men on these boats that are churning through the water, not knowing if they're going to hit a mine. And boy, if they make it through the mine, your reward, the door opens and you run onto a beach meeting fire from the Germans. I am amazed every time I talk about it, just how incredible the men were that did this. And of course, it's important to remember. Thank you. And we've had a lot of comments from people saying that they enjoy these little moments just as a reminder of what everyone went through. And I think it's important to continue to teach that to future generations. But I'll get up my soapbox now. So that was June the 5th, 1944. Oh, and if you're a fan of Les Mis, according to Wikipedia, Colm Wilkinson, who was in Les Mis, the original cast, was born on this day, June the 5th, 1944. The things you can learn on Wikipedia about war and the birth of your famous favorite Broadway stars. Continue to share on the text line or the phone line any thoughts you have of veterans in your life, or perhaps you are one serving in World War II or that you knew of. But let's continue on with the lead up to and now D-Day that I've been doing the past couple days. Little historical lessons, if you don't mind me going into it a little bit. So we left off in the overnight hours from June the 5th into June the 6th. We already, by midnight, have troops behind enemy lines that have landed in gliders, crash-landed in gliders. That's what they do. Well off course. The wind blew them completely in the wrong places. They have no idea where they are. So the overnight hours is a bunch of men who crashed in gliders trying to find each other amongst the hedgerows. And the gunfire is starting at this point. Maybe the Germans aren't entirely aware that an invasion is happening, but something is happening. And it's frightening. 1,200 aircraft departed England before midnight. Three airborne divisions, 1,200 aircraft, dropping those men behind enemy lines several hours before the beach landings. The American 82nd and 101st Airborne Divisions assigned to objectives on the peninsula west of Utah Beach. The British 6th Airborne Division assigned to capture the bridges along the rivers in France. It was a cloudy day. The sunrise in Normandy on June the 6th, 1944, was 5:55 in the morning. The ships could be seen approaching the beaches a little bit before then. It was a Tuesday. And by the numbers, some 132,000 men were transported by sea, undetected, leading into D-Day. 24,000 men by air. Preliminary naval bombardment started 10 minutes before the sunrise, 5:45 in the morning, and continued until 6:25 a.m., bombarding the beaches from five battleships, 20 cruisers, 65 destroyers, two monitor ships, carrying 132,000 men who had to go through minefields in the sea. And while some people may have been aware something was happening, this is largely a surprise invasion of the French coast. Infantry began arriving on the beaches at 6:30 in the morning. I think it's important to remember the men came from the Allies' powers. I think everyone knows United States, United Kingdom, Canada, France, of course, a participant in it. It was their home turf. But thousands of troops from Poland, Australia, New Zealand, Czechoslovakia, Greece, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Norway, South Africa, Southern Rhodesia. That's the countries that contributed to the forces that landed on the beaches that day against the Axis powers, the Germans, and of course the Italians. Although a couple days ago we did mention that Rome had fallen, the president, or the king, excuse me, of Italy had essentially said the war is over. It had been liberated, but some Italians were still fighting for the Axis powers. And five beaches, it began. The craft bearing the U.S. 4th Infantry Division, assaulted Utah Beach. They were pushed by the current to a spot some 2,000 yards south of their intended landing zone. The troops there, though, were met with light resistance. They did suffer fewer than 200 casualties. That's still 200 lives that weren't coming back. Mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters, uncles, aunts, grandparents, kids that never got to see their loved one again. But it was less than 200 at Utah Beach. Their efforts to push inland fell far short of their targets on the first day, but they advanced 4 miles on June the 6th. At Gold Beach, high winds made conditions really difficult for the landing craft. They had those amphibious DD tanks. They were landed as close to shore as they could, or trying to get onto the beach, but they were way further out in the sea than they intended. Aerial attacks had failed to hit the German stronghold, too, so it was a real battle, and the gunners continued to fire at people landing on Gold Beach until 4 in the afternoon. So you're at about 10 hours of gunfire at Gold Beach. Landings of infantry at Juno Beach delayed because of rough seas. The men arrived ahead of their armor, suffering many casualties while just simply getting off the boats. You've seen that in Saving Private Ryan. They were ahead of what was supposed to protect them. Aerial attacks also had failed there as well. They had missed the German defenses. But in spite of these difficulties, the Canadians at Juno Beach quickly cleared the beach and created two exits to the villages above. Sword Beach, 21 of the 25 tanks did succeed in getting safely ashore, providing cover for the infantry, who began disembarking at 7:30 in the morning. They quickly cleared the beach, created several exits for tanks. In the windy conditions, though, the tide came in way more quickly than expected. Maneuvering the armor was very difficult. And again, they were way off course. And at 4 in the afternoon, Germany's 21st Panzer Division, they actually mounted a counterattack. They almost got all the way back to the coast. After a great morning, a real difficult afternoon, but still they fought on. And then Omaha. Omaha was the most heavily defended sector. It was assigned to the U.S. 1st Infantry Division, supplemented by troops from the U.S. 29th. Strong currents forced many landing craft well east of their intended positions. Casualties were heavier than all the other beaches combined. Men were subjected to fire from the cliffs above, never ending. Exit from Omaha was possible only via five little gullies, little dugout things in the sand. And by late morning, barely 600 men had reached higher ground. By noon, the artillery fire took its toll and the Germans started to run out of ammunition. The Americans were able to clear some lanes on the beaches, but they didn't reach their goals for D-Day until 4 days later. The entire naval armada bringing these men across the channel, all those ships, only one ship was lost. It was an Allied ship. The Svenner was less than a year old. It was hit by two torpedoes from German U-boats making its way across the channel. It broke into two, sank very quickly. 32 Norwegian crewmen were killed. In the afternoon, Winston Churchill announced the Normandy landings. He addressed the House of Commons. He said, "I cannot, of course, commit myself to any particular details. Reports are coming in rapid succession. So far, the commanders who are engaged report that everything is proceeding according to plan, and what a plan." Adolf Hitler was awoken around noon, informed of the landings. He didn't display any outward signs of distress. He appeared to be confident that the invasion would be repulsed. It wasn't. It wasn't even close. There were incredible losses on June the 6th. 4,414 Allied troops killed. 2,500 of them were Americans. More than 5,000 were wounded. As Operation Overlord, as it was called, continued over the ensuing weeks, 40,000 civilians were killed, 2,000 Polish infantrymen, 5,000 Canadian soldiers, 11,000 British soldiers, and 20,668 Americans were killed in the entire operation. And one of them was a brigadier general. He was one of the first soldiers there off his landing craft. In fact, that day, he was the only general to do that. He led the 8th landing at Utah Beach. He was 56 years old. He was the oldest person involved in D-Day, and he led his men through battle. And in the middle of it, he started feeling a very heavy feeling in his chest. But he fought on, leading his men. After the battle, he led his troops for the ensuing days in a Jeep that they nicknamed Rough Rider, which was a fitting nickname because they named it after the troops his father had led decades earlier, before the world knew him as Teddy Roosevelt. That was General Teddy Roosevelt Jr., Teddy Roosevelt's son, who then died of a heart attack in the weeks after the attack. But on the night of June the 6th, it was his cousin back in Washington who wrapped up the day with an address to the nation, a six-minute prayer that began like this.
Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed. But we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph.
Amen. It's FDR addressing the nation this night, 80 years ago.